From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America has a global image problem. The sympathy people felt overseas for the U.S. last September has evaporated. The international community, even American allies, sees the land of the free as the home of the arrogant, hypocritical, and self-absorbed. And you can put quotes around those words. They're the findings of a survey commissioned by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York in a special task force. And it appears the White House is listening, this week announcing the formation of an Office of Global Communications. This hour, America's international image problem, or the Bush administration's listening problem. We begin tonight with a look at King Abdullah of Jordan's visit to Washington. When he met with President Bush today, King Abdullah delivered a clear message. There's little support among Middle East leaders for a war in Iraq. Earlier, I spoke with Rami Khoury, former editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times. I asked him what the Jordanian people expected from today's meeting.
Well, the expectation was that the king would see several key leaders in Europe and France and England, and then go to the U.S. and talk to President Bush and try to emphasize to them, especially to the Americans, how dangerous it would be if the United States unilaterally and militarily tried to change the government in Iraq. I mean, there's no doubt that the United States could do this, and there's no doubt that it would do it if it felt that it was an important thing to do for American national interest or just American presidential ego or revenge or whatever reason might come out of Washington. There's no doubt it could be done, but the consequences might be really very severe for not just the people in Iraq and the people in the region, but globally as well, in terms of oil production, in terms of anti-American sentiment. So the king was trying to make that clear, that this is not a barbecue jamboree in Texas. This is a pretty serious thing when the global power goes around changing governments militarily, when the whole world, literally the whole world, except possibly Israel and the United States, almost everybody else in the world disagrees with what the American president is talking about.
Of course, this is not necessarily a message that is new. I mean, presumably Jordanian diplomats, along with diplomats from the region, have been trying to make this point for some time. I mean, he felt the need to go and meet him face to face.
Yes, it's not the first time, by the way. This is the third time that King Abdullah goes to Washington this year, and there's been regular contacts over the phone and other Arab leaders talking to the American leadership and telling them the same things. But I think the frequency and the intensity and the increasing clarity and sincerity on the bluntness in which King Abdullah is talking and others are talking, I think should be taken in Washington as a message, as an indicator that there is real concern what might happen if the Americans did this. I mean, I should say at the same time, to be fair, that I think there's universal displeasure in the Middle East with the Iraqi regime. And we're not saying that this is a great regime. No, this is a pretty brutal regime, and we all feel that U.N. sanctions were appropriate after the Gulf War. The Iraqis were a threat, a real threat to several of their neighbors. And so there is a real concern about making sure that Iraq and other countries in the region don't develop weapons of mass destruction. But what we're saying, and what King Abdullah and others are saying, is that unilateral American military action is not the appropriate response.
Of course, today's meeting was overshadowed by yet another bombing in Israel. And the president was, when he commented earlier in the day, I mean, most of his comments were actually about that particular atrocity. So it's difficult to get a message, I would imagine, about prospective military action against Iraq when the other part of the Middle East problem keeps bloodily rearing its head.
Yeah, and there is a linkage. I mean, the point that King Abdullah and others are making to the American leadership is that there is a restless, angry, really bothered and almost dehumanized citizenry out here in the Arab world. And the reason they're like this is because of the double whammy they feel that we're getting from the United States. One is American continued aggression in Iraq and the no-fly zones, which the U.S. and England are doing with no U.N. resolutions for them, and this strict embargo on Iraq. And then on the other side, the American acquiescence or sometimes even approval of what Israel is doing against the Palestinians. There is a linkage between these two things. And one of the messages that the Arabs are telling the American leadership is you've got to work harder to tone down the war in Palestine and Israel and try to resolve that fairly, and that would reduce the dangers of having upheaval and political turbulence and even some countries being governments being overthrown in the Middle East if the U.S. were to attack Iraq. So the two things have to be looked at as part of an integrated emotional whole.
You've alluded to it already, Rami Khoury, but tell us, in your country, what is the general view of the United States and the way it's conducting itself in the world at the moment?
The general view is a peculiar combination of a great respect and admiration and envy for many of the cultural values, scientific and technological achievements, political values and social traditions and popular culture in the United States. So there's a lot of respect and envy and appreciation for that side of the United States. And at the same time, there is almost universal and very strong disdain for the conduct of American foreign policy in this region, of which the American psychological warfare now talking about Iraq, attacking Iraq unilaterally and changing the leadership is a prime example. So it's a peculiar combination of a kind of a love-hate relationship. Most of the people like what they see in America in terms of the people and their values and their achievements, but we don't like what we see the American government doing in terms of foreign policy. And this is a very important dichotomy that Americans should understand, because it's been simplified too much when people say, why do they hate us in the United States? That really is an imbecilic thing to say. It's just inaccurate. It's not fair, and it's not useful. The question is, why do people criticize American foreign policy, and at the same time, they seem to embrace many other parts of American culture?
Rami Khoury, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rami Khoury is an internationally syndicated political columnist, former editor-in-chief of the Jordan Times. He spoke with us earlier from Amman, Jordan. We're talking this hour about improving America's image abroad. Will marketing brand America change global perceptions? Or does the heart of America's problem lie not in its image, but in the Bush administration's foreign policies? Join the conversation, On Point listeners, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me in this conversation from New York is David Morey, who is co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force that just published the report, Public Diplomacy, A Strategy for Reform. He's also the chief executive of DMG Incorporated, a strategic communications consultant group, and he's also an adjunct professor of international affairs at Columbia University. Good evening, David.
Pleasure to be here.
And also joining us from New York is Mike Moran, who's foreign affairs columnist and senior producer at MSNBC Special Reports. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Let me turn to you first, David, and ask you, there's a lot of anecdotal stuff about foreign perceptions of the United States, but the interesting thing about this report is that there's a fair amount of public opinion research. What are the key findings?
Well, I mean, they're troublesome, and this goes beyond a popularity contest. They go to the heart and soul of the new challenge that America faces in a very interdependent world. Remember, there's a lot of mistruths that have been told about America in faraway places. The world has changed because of the information revolution, because government-directed communications are less efficient, effective, and credible, and finally, because they're very much entrenched negatives, perceptions toward America in different parts of the world, even sometimes among our allies, significant public diplomacy challenges, maybe even crises. But let's go to the Middle East and the Muslim part of the Middle East for a second. It's worrisome. In Jordan, a recent poll determined that 88% and in Saudi Arabia, 82% of those polled had a favorable opinion perception of Osama bin Laden. Those are higher approval ratings than President George Bush enjoys today. That's worrisome.
David, equally worrisome, or I don't know if it's worrisome, but it's certainly interesting to me, is to look at opinion in Europe. I mean, that people in that region, in Muslim countries, feel something about Osama bin Laden is actually less surprising to me than some of the negatives that you came away with surveying in Europe.
I think that's a good point. And I think that there are divides between the U.S. and our allies that are worrisome. And that's all about a new world of public diplomacy in which we have to operate, in which information becomes part of national security. And, listen, in the 30,000 madrasas in Pakistan, they're not exactly they may teach kids math, which is 2 + 2 = 7, but they're not teaching them the truth about America either. And, you know, that's a problem that is endangering American national security. It's also a problem if our allies have divides and misperceptions. And on a range of issues, which we can talk about tonight, the report of the Council on Foreign Relations finds, and this is an independent task force from the Council, for example, the Kyoto policy, the anti-landmine policy, for example, the International Criminal Court decision, and the decision not to join the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, we can agree or disagree about those policies, but I'm not sure. I'm wondering who would want to say we've articulated them effectively,
well,
or we've communicated the context in which those decisions are made. I think we have to do a better job at that.
Let me ask Mike Moran, is this simply a question of better communicating with our allies overseas, or the populations of our allies overseas? We get confused. I'm not talking about speaking directly to heads of state. We're talking about getting a message out to ordinary people. Or is there a problem with the policy, Mike?
Well, I mean, that was my major concern with the report, is that it seemed to focus so much on the spin, and it never really dealt with the issue of what if the negative reality that's being you know, seized upon in overseas actually reflects reality. It's a hard question for Americans to grapple with. We are, in some ways, because we are so huge, because we've spent a decade atrophying in our opinions of the world, in our sense that the world even mattered to our lives, we are willfully ignorant of what the world is. Our politicians are as driven by Democratic and forces as any in the world, polling, all the things that this report suggests that we apply to the world. And yet, what are we saying? Are we saying we need to twist what we really are and show a different face to the world? Or are we really saying we need to explain better a beneficent worldview? I think that's the problem with the report. I think that's the problem that the report doesn't really address. Is American foreign policy actually beneficent?
David, come back on that.
Can I challenge that?
Sure, David.
I disagree completely with that, Mike, respectfully. I think the report has almost nothing to do with spin. It never mentions spin. I don't think it even articulates anything close to spin. The report, I think, just the opposite. I mean, the report argues, I think, strenuously, that you can't fake this. This is not about a public relations campaign. This is, in fact, about substance. It's not about selling America. It's about revealing America. It's, in fact, about this world today is about sophisticated audiences that get information. You can't fool them. You can't use PR. You can't use just sort of tactical approaches. Even advertising ought to be way, way down the list. In fact, the report argues we got to prioritize public diplomacy, put it to the center of the policymaking process. The policies themselves are the most powerful articulation of public diplomacy. Edward R. Murrow, following the Bay of Pigs, is famously remembered to say public diplomacy is brought in on the crash landings and not the takeoffs. The report argues strenuously we ought to bring public diplomacy into the center of the policymaking process. And it sounds like the Office of Global Communications is a first step. And then quickly, I know you have another question.
Well, no, I just want, David, I just wanted to pick up on something that Mike said. I frame the discussion as saying that much of the sympathy that the U.S. garnered in the wake of the attack on September 11th has been squandered. And Mike was saying, well, this is a problem that actually goes back 10 years and has much more to do with the inward turning of the U.S. And it's not just ordinary Americans who don't have a great interest in the rest of the planet, but certainly some people who are now making policy in the Bush administration come from this background, no?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very fair point to say that America was moving in an isolationist direction following the end of the Cold War. I think that changed on 9/11. I think in a symbolic sense, in a very tragic sense, the interdependence of the world was brought front and center to the American attention. You know, we are an interdependent world, and extremists that are propagandized, that are told lies about America in faraway places, are a threat to U.S. national security. And I think that we have a responsibility to deal with that. The report argues we've got to revolutionize the way we approach that and use two-way communications, deal more effectively with foreign journalists.
David, yeah. I'm going to stop you there because we're coming up to the break. Okay. We're going to pick up this conversation very shortly. On Point listeners, we're talking about international image problem for America. Call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how America's policies are received overseas, the communications problem that the Bush administration has putting these things across. We're also asking, are people's resentment of America's actions in recent months based on bad projection, bad selling of policy, or is it the policy themselves? And I'm talking with David Morey, who is co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force, published a report, Public Diplomacy, Strategy for Reform, and Mike Moran, foreign affairs columnist, senior producer at MSNBC, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join in this conversation. David, I had to interrupt you just as we were coming into the break. I'd just like you to summarize and finish that point, please.
Thanks. Be happy to. Again, I think this is not a PR campaign for America. I think that'd be a mistake. I think it's much deeper, more significant, more meaningful. I think the policies do communicate maybe more loudly than anything else. The actions, the aid packages that are allocated around the world. I mean, there are a number of things that communicate, but this report calls for revolutionizing the way we train our officials. Ambassadors get, for example, 2 weeks of training, almost none of it, about an hour on public diplomacy. There's a 7-week program for foreign service officers, an hour devoted to public diplomacy. We've got to start thinking about this differently. We've got to start listening more effectively to the world.
Okay. David, let me just ask Mike a question just practically. Can you think of an instance in the last 90, 120 days where the response back from out there has simply not got through the filters in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. I think we should lay down the Middle East as one example of that, first of all. I mean, there's an enormous split between the people, what you might call the professional foreign policy establishment, over how to handle the Middle East, and the people who are running foreign policy, who are in the Bush administration, who are having an enormous difficulty distinguishing or at least explaining why the world of the war on terrorism has no gray areas, but the world in the Middle East should. That in many ways, this is the nexus of the problem. To be able to, and it's particularly if we're speaking about public opinion in the Middle East, which in the end is really the game. Are we talking about, you know, if we're talking about populations that create people who are willing to kill themselves for a cause, if we are to deal with people like that, we need to convince the governments of those countries that the actions we take will be somehow at least rationalizable to the populations that they rule. These are not democracies. Let's face it. We haven't over the last 40 years, and this is our failing, asked Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Egypt or any of the countries that we regard as our allies in that region to become democracies. That is our failing, and we're living the hell of that failing right now. But essentially, if we're going to pursue a policy that attempts to neutralize the arguments of a man like Osama bin Laden, we've got to offer more than the fact that we are the superpower, the fact that we are right. We say we are right, and we say that over and over. We say that our values are the values that are right over and over again. The Voice of America is out there doing it. There are, American media, American culture is a very powerful tool to do that. This is not absent from the world. I actually believe in much of what this report says. What bothers me about it is that it seems as though we've bent over backwards, or at least the council has bent over backwards, to try to give constructive criticism of something that needs to be more destructive. We need to be a little tougher on the way we approach the world. Otherwise, what we're really doing is we're nipping and tucking around the edges of something that's a real problem.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Billy is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Billy.
I just wanted to say that I worked for state and USIA for 21 years in Asia and Africa and India. And during that time, I felt that one of the nicest things going was the Voice of America, which I worked on when I was in Washington for assignment. But unfortunately, we never were allowed to put the Voice of America broadcasted in America so that our own people could know what was happening around the world. And I don't think we were BBC, but we were very good on international news. And I think if America had known many of the things that we broadcast, that things would be much different today. I realized that they voted not to broadcast in America because it was right after World War II and they were afraid of a propaganda machine. And that would not have been so good. But
okay,
the other thing I want to say is that our aid program was mishandled in many ways. Aside from being too military, the money never trickled down because much of the money was kept right in America. They had to buy their things from America, and the money stayed here, so it never got to the people it was intended for. And we never followed through to see if the money did get there. Those are the points I wanted to make.
Well, Billy, thank you very much for your call. Let me just throw this one last thought over to David Morey. That communication is a two-way street. Now, Mike was talking about that, and Billy was as well, that it's got to come back. That has to be part of public diplomacy, doesn't it?
There's no doubt. And I agree with Mike to the extent, and I think this report gets very into the point that it's all about policy, and policy is fundamental to public diplomacy. But indeed, I think we've got to think, you know, if you look at the surveying of this report, too often we're in the old sort of Cold War approach or paradigm to public diplomacy. It's one-way communications. We're speaking, or even in the more pejorative sense, teaching different foreign populations. That doesn't work today. It's got to be more of a two-way dialogue where we're really understanding different shared values. We're learning from each other. People-to-people exchanges, I just cite as a quick example here, even though the private sector has spent more money on that, it's diminished by almost 40% in terms of federal funding between 93 and 2001. It's gone down in countries, Muslim countries, during the time when their populations have gone up. You know, those kinds of programs have to be re-energized, even revolutionized. You know, Billy makes a great point in terms of aid. You know, we haven't really, the world has a very narrow, distorted, and controlled view of America, particularly in parts of the Middle East. But this is an issue that goes beyond the Middle East, as I say.
Yeah.
And we've got to educate and get our side of the story out.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now Hussein Haqqani, who's in Washington, D.C. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former advisor to Pakistani Prime Ministers Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. Hussein Haqqani, when you work closely to the head of another state, what is it like when you're dealing with the United States and they want something from you?
Well, I think that it differs from diplomat to diplomat, but the fact remains that people in the United States are very inward-looking. We know that only 5% of Americans have ever bothered to obtain a passport. Only 45% of American congressmen have passports, which means basically the rest of the world does not feature in their lives as much as it does as America features in the lives of leaders of the rest of the world.
So can you think of an instance where Washington wanted something from one of the Pakistani prime ministers you served that might not have actually been in their best interest, but they had to deal with this big request?
Well, I think there were more than one occasions. For example, Nawaz Sharif had been elected on the platform of giving Pakistan a nuclear deterrent against India in his first term. And the United States wanted Pakistan to give up working on a nuclear weapons program. The U.S., of course, applied sanctions. The U.S. Administration was engaged in discussion just when some people in Congress decided, well, we'll have legislative action to suspend all assistance and all cooperation with Pakistan, thereby giving up the leverage that the U.S. had with Pakistan to try and exercise leverage. And that really jeopardized U.S.-Pakistan relations well until 9/11, when Pakistan was needed again and the U.S. ended all sanctions. So that was one example.
Does this build up resentment? I'm thinking how things get disseminated. Mike,
let me give you an instance. The American ambassador comes by. He sees the prime minister, gives him what are known as talking points, tells him, look, this is what we think you ought to do. The prime minister tries to tell him, no, it is not something that I can do. I'm prepared to concede the basic grounds, but I'm going to try and do it another way. And, of course, the ambassador then says, well, it's beyond me because I'm just just a postman, the fact remains that the people who are making the policy have already made up their minds. I think one of your previous speakers was saying that there has to be a two-way communication, and I think that often is missing because people sitting in Washington sometimes think that, look, we can have our way, and therefore there is a tendency to be a little bit more bullying than cajoling or convincing.
Mike Moran.
Michael, I think I find it very useful in explaining this to people to think of the world as having been arranged in a marriage with the United States. We are, unfortunately, and fortunately for us, the largest and most powerful country on the planet. The rest of the world has to deal with that day in and day out. There is no choice. And your guest described perfectly the dance that the diplomats do before. For instance, today when King Abdullah met George Bush, King Abdullah may well have wanted to educate George Bush on certain things, and he certainly knows a lot more about certain things than George Bush. But there was no way that King Abdullah was going to get that opportunity, at least after the meeting in public, to speak his mind very, very cogently on what he thought of American policy in the Middle East. That is both the advantage of being the superpower, but it's also the disadvantage. It's the blinder we wear in the world. We go into the world and we assume that, well, okay, we will, for the sake of appearances, ask the French what they think. We'll ask the Egyptians what they think. We'll ask the Pakistanis what they think. But in the end, we'll essentially tell them that this is what we think, and we'll let you spin this any way you want for your domestic audience, as long as it doesn't cause too much trouble. But this is the way we want it, and this is the way we'll have it. The problem with that approach, and this is where this report is excellent, is that ultimately in the modern world where you have Al Jazeera, where you have CNN, where you have BBC World Service, and countless other global communications means, which are not ignorant, which are very sophisticated, analytical media outlets, that gets picked apart and seen for what it is. It is essentially imperialism.
David Moore.
If I may come in.
I'd love to come in. May I come in on that point?
Yeah, we'll keep it going in a polite round robin. David Moore and then Hussein Haqqani.
Great. Thanks. I think Michael makes a very, very good point. I mean, the burdens and responsibilities of superpowerdom are significant, and this is a gigantic issue. One of the things the council report argues strenuously is we ought to very seriously look at some privatization, the creation of, we call it as a marker, the Corporation for Public Diplomacy, which would be funded solely by private funds, a little bit modeled after the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, because we think you need maybe to create a private entity that has some separation from the U.S. government, that has more flexibility.
Isn't that what globalization is all about? I mean, I'm serious, David. I mean, I know you're talking about a private entity to deal with these issues of public diplomacy, but in a curious way, isn't that sort of what our international businesses are doing?
I think so, but there's no coordination of that. Let me give you a specific issue. The U.S. has a hard time recruiting the best practices, the best talent, the best people. You know, everyone knows that a salesman is only as good as the sort of salesman himself. The message is only as credible as the messenger. And, you know, sometimes some independence is needed for a credibility of message. And I think an independent entity bears examination in terms of the creation. It would provide a certain separation between itself and the U.S. government. Right now, U.S. diplomats can only really stick to their talking points and principally talk only to other diplomats. So, you know, it seems to me, you know, to create an entity that would allow a more independent body of spokespeople around the world would be very interesting and very revolutionary in the way that it's approached. I mean, the corporations do that, but there's no sort of coordination sense or rhyme, no reason, nor how that comes about.
David, Michael, to break protocol for just a second, as an alumnus of the BBC World Service and of Radio Free Europe, I can absolutely say that David is right there. And that is one of the drawbacks that Voice of America has always faced, despite its dedicated and very professional staff. In the end of the day, on the eve of the the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the Voice of America had its mouth shut. And that is the kind of problem of credibility that you can't recover from. That's a generation-old memory that in the Arab world will stick with. It just simply sticks with people.
Hussein, I just very quickly, because I've got a lot of calls, and I also want to go to callers, too.
I was just going to say that in the question of the arranged marriage analogy, let's just say that this is a polygamous marriage, because the world thinks differently, and everybody has a mind of their own. And if you're going to use a marketing analogy, then we must remember that the product has to be marketed differently to different audiences. Coke understands that. When it goes to Africa, it focuses on a different aspect. When it goes to the Middle East, it uses different icons to sell itself. I think that the United States, in terms of its policy, first of all, has to be more interactive in making that policy, and secondly, even in terms of a marketing strategy, it has to understand that it is dealing with different audiences, and different marketing strategies are needed for different parts of the world.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Todd is on the line.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Todd.
Well, it may be an oversimplification, but I wanted to offer an observation, because in talking about the U.S. as the last great superpower, we're also having a conversation about how to have the dialogue of diplomacy better. And there seems to be a core contradiction since, and I know 9/11 has been a great framework for this conversation, but we started at 9/11 in a place where the righteousness of going after the perpetrators of a heinous act was agreed upon to the world community, and we seem to have come around to are trying to spin that into this changing a regime in Iraq, which is really nothing more than an illustration of the might makes right principle. It makes me nervous. I'm powerful enough to change it, and so I may do it. And that's the notion that seems to me completely antithetical to the democratic principle. And I guess what I'm concerned about is two things. One is that seems to present a kind of a hypocritical face when we enter into a conversation of diplomacy, but it also seems to edge dangerously into setting a precedent that's almost reckless.
Yeah, Todd, let me just pose that as a question to Mike or David. The hypocritical nature of American policy, particularly in the last 4 or 5 months, how does that affect, say, we've been talking about the Middle East, what about in Europe?
Michael, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I think that in particular in Europe, actually, that's a very good example of where this kind of thing plays very badly. And to be fair, having been, as Michael was, in Europe all through the Bosnia adventure, Europe has really very, very soft ground to stand on here. They really did speak out of one side of their mouth and act another way. But I think that what Europe sees now is a country that's willing to hold up international treaties and laws and standards as long as it advances its own interests, and then cast them aside immediately when it becomes an inconvenience. Not even an obstacle, but an inconvenience. And that is really a problem.
We're coming into the break. We're going to pick up the conversation very shortly. A question to think about, listeners. We think we're in a global war. Over there, people say, what war? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. Just before the break, I was posing the question that it's a perception. I live most of the year in London, and you over there, you wouldn't know that there was a war on, and I come here and I look at the television, I read the papers, and global war on terrorism is being prosecuted, and we're reorganizing the country. And there is an extraordinary disconnect, at least between Europe and here. But I'm wondering, Hussein Haqqani, is that disconnect also present, say, in South Asia, where you're from, in Pakistan?
Well, we must remember that Pakistan is, of course, where the war is being prosecuted from. There's military bases being used, there are American troops there, and of course, Afghanistan is just next door. So yes, there is a greater feeling of a war in progress, but the fact remains that the main medium that people have of information in Pakistan is no different from that in the rest of the world. People watch BBC, people watch CNN, and their coverage determines some of the understanding of the issues locally, except those who just do not agree with any of the Western media and then turn to alternative media, which is very hostile to the United States. I just want to make one comment that comes from earlier discussion. It's not so much the hypocrisy that bothers people in the third world who are anti-American or critical of the U.S. I think people are more bothered by the fact that instead of conceding that there is a hypocrisy or inherent hypocrisy, the U.S. insists on being very self-righteous. So, for example, it wants to prosecute a war against Saddam Hussein for being authoritarian and for having weapons of mass destruction. But say, for example, General Musharraf has weapons of mass destruction and he's an ally. Similarly, Hosni Mubarak is a dictator and he's not supposed to be a bad guy. And that kind of confuses how the U.S. is seen. A person says, you want democracy around the world, I want to help you, but why don't you want democracy in my country? And that is really one of the biggest problems of U.S. foreign policy, not the hypocrisy, but the inability to explain to people why the manner in which it affects them is not necessarily the best manner it should affect them.
Let me make a point on that, if I could. This is David Morey. Yeah. I think that it's true we have a public diplomacy crisis challenge problem. In other regions of the world, I think it's crossed different administrations. It's not just the last months under the Bush administration. We've underfunded and in a way been inattentive to public diplomacy for the last 10 years. Let me make a point that I think is very, very critical. This issue of the U.S. arranged marriage with the rest of the world is an interesting one, and the superpowerdom of the U.S. We're in new territory here, and this may be the most complicated time in foreign policy history. The U.S. has a stronger, leaving the economy for aside, back in 1900, Britain had a two-navy advantage, and they had the largest gap in military power at that time in history. Today, the U.S., in military terms, its defense budget combines the next 16 countries. And some of those are allies, and that doesn't even include the technological advantages the U.S. military has. The U.S. has a gigantic power advantage in the traditional term of power in military power, to some extent in economic power. Today, the paradox or the irony is soft power becomes critical. You know, it's the power of information.
This is Joseph Nye's argument, Joseph Nye, at the Kennedy School of Government.
And the point is that, you know, we can't go it alone. This world requires interdependence, coalitions, and that's what makes the U.S. Decision-making process very, very challenging.
But in the last 4 or 5 months in particular, Mike, I mean, the U.S. is actually, even before September 11th, with the Kyoto Treaty being kicked into touch, I mean, it's really very clear that the United States, or at least this administration, feels that it can behave in a unilateral fashion.
Yeah.
And let me pose the question, since we don't have anybody from the Heritage Foundation on the panel. Let me just pose the question, what's wrong with behaving unilaterally if you've got the power to do it?
Well, the unilateral argument, which I've heard again and again, and I respect many of the people who make it, because they look at the energy that we spend, what they see as mollifying the rest of the world as a waste, that there is no amount of ego stroking and nice talk that will make, let's say, the Iranians begin to stop sending money to Hezbollah, or the French stop feeling as though for some reason they lost their inheritance and wound up a second class power. That is, you know, there's something to be said for that. It is true that international friction over issues like that will always exist. The really more important argument, to my mind, is that ultimately the United States, if you look at the arrests, just a simple measure, the arrests made of suspected al-Qaeda members, these arrests were made in Spain, in Italy, in Malaysia, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Russia, in places that we simply don't have jurisdiction. The kind of cooperation, you can create a world where the United States sets itself up as a kind of gendarme or as a big, bad, don't mess with me kind of a country. And what you've essentially set up there is a retaliatory, a kind of cycle of touch me and I will retaliate. It becomes an ultimatum. You hit me, I'm going to hit you. If you set up the only way to really undermine a system like that, and I hate to say it, but the Israelis have fallen into this trap in a terrible way. They are now in this awful cycle of having to retaliate, and God knows our heart goes out to them in some ways. What they're being subjected to is horrible, but they are subjecting their enemy to the same type of horrors, and that is a terrible thing. It has gotten them stuck in a cycle, in a tornado that politically they can't get out of. The United States, to get sucked into the same kind of thing on a global level, would be a disaster. What the United States can do to break out of that is to lean on its friends. The United States has chits. The United States has sympathy around the world. In the majority of countries, you will find, and I think, and the report showed this, that there is a great deal of sympathy for the United States on a visceral level, on a cultural level, on a social level. Americans, as people, are not hated. America, as somebody who walks into your front yard and says, "Well, we're the big bad dog. Get out of my way." That is what is hated. There's a better way to do that. And I think getting from here to there in this administration is a tall order. But I still think that ultimately you cannot win the war on terrorism alone.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Susan is on the line.
I'm going to change my question, if I may.
You can't. You can. No, it's, go ahead. It's all right.
And it's basically, I want to address the question you asked earlier, which was, you know, based on asking somebody from the Heritage Foundation, what's wrong with unilateralism? And I'd like to respond, but not as somebody from the Heritage Foundation. I think what's wrong with unilateralism is it is anti-democratic. And I think that if we truly believe in democracy, that has to be for all people. And that means that when we make decisions that affect the whole world, that we have to ask the whole world what they want.
Is that practicable, David Morey?
I just think unilateralism isn't an option. In all deference to our the unmanned heritage position here on the phone.
Susan's question about involving, asking people, when the United States is taking government, I hate that shorthand, which is the United States, because it implies that it's me or you or anybody. These are the actions of governments. Mm-hmm. Takes actions that are going to have deep impact on people in another country. Do we have a responsibility, David Morey, to kind of be checking out public opinion and talking to them?
Absolutely. And not only responsibility, it will. There's almost a certainty that we'll fail if we don't. I mean, if we don't build coalitions and if we don't put public diplomacy to the center of the policymaking process so that it actually gets right in the middle of the process, not even maybe to change it, but to certainly articulate the context of why we do what we do, we will fail in foreign policy terms. It's that complicated a communication society in which we have to wage foreign policy today. I don't think, I agree with Mike, unilateralism isn't an option. We can only operate in coalitions, and we've got to make the case. In an interdependent world, we can't depend on this, Joe Nye's definition of hard power.
Susan, I want to thank you for your call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Richard is on the line. Richard?
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm not Richard, but I'm glad that I got in. U.S. will win the whole world hands down when it comes to technology and intel and computers. But we have to remember there are thousands of years of cultures behind the civilizations in all over the world. And if they make any judgments, if they make any decisions, I know it is not about technology, but when it comes to human relations, we have to give them some credit that is based on something. And if the whole world is against the policies of U.S. in the Middle East and against the Palestinians and favoring the Israelis, that is not based on some short-term study. That is based on thousands of years of human literature and poetry and feelings. So we have to give them a little bit of respect and listen to what they say.
What was your name?
My name is Hamid.
Hamid, thank you for your call, Hamid, and thank you for that comment. What I'd like to do, though, is we were getting to the point with Susan about in the unilateralism question. The reason we're having this conversation, I think, to a considerable degree, is that at the moment, it's pretty clear that there aren't a lot of voices either from overseas or people who are respectful of voices from overseas and based in America getting through to policymakers in the administration. So, David, how do you go about changing that?
Well, I mean, I think you would have to work hard to make the case. I think, you know, around the Middle East, for example, there's not a lot of love lost for Saddam Hussein. If the president, if the administration, if Congress ultimately decides to invade Iraq, we can debate whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. But it certainly is being debated now, and that's good in a healthy debate. There's quiet support and there's more frontal and public support. We would have to have a significant coalition of support at the public and private level, at the military level, to succeed. We can't do anything. Let's forget about invading Iraq. Back to Mike's point about fighting the war against terror. We have to fight that war. I think we have no choice. But we will not win the war unless we win friends and allies in that process. And
but is the administration hearing that message, David? Do you have any indication, and Mike, you can just jump in here. I mean, what we've been seeing over the last since actually the success of routing the Taliban is an increasingly isolated, it seems to me, foreign policy group, doesn't include Colin Powell, in the White House, making these decisions. And what I'm asking is, how do we get a message through to them that there has to be more public display of understanding that other countries do have differing views and they're entitled to them?
Well, the report is aggressive in saying that the administration needs to do more and do it better and do it faster. And part of that, as the last caller suggested, is listening, expressing. You know, empathy is a very important thing that has to be expressed effectively around the world. All the research teaches us that it's missing. People don't think the U.S. cares. And I'm not sure that's true. I'm certain, in fact, the opposite is true. The U.S. does care. We don't articulate that effectively. And it sounds very sort of gooey here, but it's not unimportant. We've got to be respectful. We've got to express empathy across the world in many ways in terms of many different situations.
I think that there is a point that was not made early on, which I was disappointed with, in that any other country that had been hit the way we were hit, that possessed the power that we possess, would have hit back very much harder than we did. I really believe that in my heart. I think one of the great things that Americans can be proud of here, we've been bashing American policy, is that the early talk of tactical nuclear retaliation and such things was squelched, and it did not happen. And I think Americans should be proud of that. That would have been a disaster. It would have immediately squandered what in essence took us 8 months to squander. But I do think there's a couple of other interesting points to be made. You can't, as David said, you cannot operate in the modern world without coalitions. Though we are enormously powerful militarily and our economy is huge, this is not a world, as in World War II, where the rest of the world is either underdeveloped completely or in ruins from a war. This is a world where the rest of the world can completely go on its own path and ignore us completely. They don't really need us as much as they did in 1945. 1945, they needed our largesse. In 2002, the world can look at us and say, they're conducting a war on terrorism. And they can individually decide whether or not that makes any sense for them. It's not, even though we have the ability to push individual governments in and out of coalitions, they are not going to join them out of principle. We need to make it obvious to them that it's in their interest. Europe is a great example. Europe right now is very happy not to be involved in this war. The stupidest thing that could possibly happen from Al-Qaeda's point of view is to attack something in Europe. And it's not going to happen precisely because they're very comfortable outside the coalition right now.
Mike Moran, thank you very much. Mike Moran, foreign affairs columnist, senior producer at MSNBC. David Morey, thank you very much. Co-chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force that just published the report, Public Diplomacy, Strategy for Reform. And thanks also to Hussein Haqqani, who joined us from Washington. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.
And this is WBUR. We're funded by